Welcome, everyone, to the Undisclosed Addendum. Support for the Undisclosed Addendum comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decisions of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/undisclosed.
Hello, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. I am John Cryer, and you are listening to the podcast about all things undisclosed. Now, it's hard to listen to the two most recent episodes of Undisclosed, The Trial and No Error Found, and not emerge in a white-hot rage. They've detailed the maddening missteps in Joey Watkins' trial and appeals process, and inspired a million questions for our listeners. And with us today is one of the hosts of Undisclosed, Colin Miller. He's an associate dean and professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at Evidence Prof Blog. How you doing, Colin?
Great, John. How about you?
Great as well, and you sound much better.
Thanks.
Also today, we have with us Scott Reeder and Seema Iyer. Scott Reeder is a nationally recognized journalist. During his decades in the news business, he has captured more than 20 national journalism awards and many more state and local commendations. His weekly column runs in more than 60 Illinois newspapers. He's the founding editor for two news services, which now serve hundreds of broadcast, print, and online outlets. And with the NPR affiliate WVIK, he now has launched the podcast Suspect Convictions, which is about a homicide he covered as a young reporter. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Great to be here.
So I listened to a bit of the podcast, and can you tell us a little bit about the case of Jennifer Ann Lewis?
It is an absolutely fascinating case. 26 years ago, I was the night cop reporter in Davenport, Iowa, for the newspaper there, and I got dispatched to a small fire at a school playground. And I arrived at the scene at the same time as the first police officer, and the two of us walked over to what we thought was going to be a trash fire. And when we saw the smoke rising from the grass, we walked over and looked down, and instead of being a trash fire, it was a 9-year-old girl that had been doused with gasoline and set on fire. And you can imagine the community was just in terror. I mean, you know, things like that aren't supposed to happen in Iowa. And within a week, the police had arrested an African-American man named Stanley Liggins, who had just been released from prison on an armed robbery charge. And there was very little evidence against him. And what we found is, the Iowa Appellate Court, I should say, has found that 78 police reports were not turned over during discovery, and they contained exculpatory evidence. We found that the star witness in the case was this woman who saw taillights near the fire, and she came forward 3 days after the arrest, and she became like the star witness during the trial. The prosecutor rolled in the back half of the car, and she testified. What turns out, the woman had been a paid police informant for 5 years, about a year before the trial, in fact. And this was never disclosed to the defense and never came out in the trial. The jurors were never informed of this. And on the first jury, it's in 1990, they put a white South African on the jury who has some interesting views on race. Let's just put it that way. I've interviewed him, and if you want to know more, you can listen to the podcast. But they not only put him on the jury, they put his wife on the jury. Have you guys ever heard of spouses being on a jury together?
I actually have. Actually,
okay.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, Seema Iyer.
Hi, everyone. Yeah, I have heard of that, and I agree with you that it's definitely suspicious. I had an issue when I did hear about it, but please go on. I don't want to interrupt.
So we have this. As we've dug more and more, he ended up, his first conviction was thrown out. They had a new trial. And part of the issue was the new trial was all the extreme publicity in the community, and they had to do a change of venue, and the Iowa Supreme Court ordered it. So he goes back to the district judge, and he gets to decide where the change of venue is going to go. Guess where he picked? Dubuque, Iowa. A community that had had cross burnings for 5 years prior, and it's the most ethnically homogenous community and one of the most ethnically homogenous states in the union. I mean, Dubuque's a wonderful town, don't get me wrong, but it's very white. I mean, I guess for want of a better word.
It's also an odd choice given the situation. But just out of curiosity, would there have been a better choice in your mind?
Oh, yes. I mean, there's a number of diverse communities in Iowa, actually. They could have gone to Des Moines. That's a fairly diverse community. They could have gone to Waterloo, which has a very high percentage of African Americans. They could have gone to even Sioux City, which has a fair number of American Indians. I mean, there's just a lot of different communities where they could have gone, where they would at least have a little bit more diversity in it. And for that matter, even in the community where the crime happened, it's about 20% African Americans. But both trials, they ended up with all white juries. It was a very curious case. So I've been fascinated by this case for years, obviously having been one of the people who found the body. Flash forward 26 years, having one of those midlife thoughts, you know, after doing all these different things in journalism, I said, you know what, my wife says, what do you really want to do? And I said, I want to write a book on this case. And she goes, do it. So I start writing a book, and I worked on it for 7 or 8 months and had 80 or so interviews recorded. And I am driving down the road with my wife, listening to Serial. And I said, you know, this is really interesting, but, you know, so is my case. I wonder if we could do a podcast on this. And I reached out to a friend at an NPR station, and within 2 days, we had a deal to co-produce a podcast. And we launched yesterday with our first 5 episodes. You can find it at suspectconvictions.com or on iTunes. It's already rising up and rapidly in iTunes. We're excited about it. But again, it's Suspect Convictions, and I invite anybody to listen to it. And I'd love to get feedback from folks. Interesting thing about this case is he has a trial coming up in May. This will be his third trial. And we're going to actually have an ending to this case, more than likely. I mean, we have something on the horizon to kind of anticipate, and we're going to be covering all the hearings coming up, and we're also going to be covering a lot of other issues and legal strategies and stuff as trial approaches.
Now, has Stanley Liggins been incarcerated this entire time?
Yes, 26 years. Oh, and I should also add, this is very undisclosed-like. There was another witness that testified, and guess who this witness was? It was his cellmate in the county jail, and the guy is a career criminal, spent most of his life in and out of Iowa prisons, and he had testified against him, saying that he admitted to the crime. So I drove out to Sioux City, Iowa, and hunted for him. He just gotten released from prison, so it's like 8-9 hours from my home, and showed up at his mother's house. Actually, his brother says, we don't know him. I go, you look just like him on Facebook. You're his brother. Okay. So we get on him on the phone, and he goes, I don't want to talk to any reporter. And I said, hey, guy, you know, my wife is absolutely going to kill me if I've driven all the way out here and you don't even talk to me. You've got to give me a break, guy. But, you know, I don't want to take that kind of heat when I get back home. Okay, I understand. I've been married. Why don't you come on down to the construction site? I'm working. That worked. It worked.
It's amazing.
And I went down and interviewed him. And I said, you know, tell me about this. And he said, they put us in the same cell together. We were together for like 6 weeks and didn't speak to each other. And he said, then they were watching TV, and this Stanley Liggins' case came up on the TV. And he's going, hey, that's you. And allegedly, Liggins said, yes, but they'll never get me for it. Now, you can interpret that a lot of different ways, but this is the grand confession that was brought forward in the trial. So I'm interviewing the guy in Sioux City who'd been a cellmate, and I said, well, you know, what compelled you to come forward? And he goes, I didn't want to testify. They had a speaker in the cell that they could listen in, and they heard him say it, the police. And he says they immediately brought him out of the cell, put him in an interrogation, and said, if you don't testify against this guy, we're going to charge you as accessory to murder. This is what he's alleging. And, of course, you know, we know that police officers can, under Supreme Court rules, lie during interrogations. He says this is what compelled him to testify against Liggins. I said, well, I noticed that you didn't go back to Fort Madison Penitentiary, which is, for those of you who aren't from the Midwest, that is like Shawshank Redemption prison times 5. It's a really nasty place where rapes and stabbings were common at that time. I mean, it was just a very scary place. And I said, you've had such a long record. They sent you to Rockwell City. And he goes, yeah. They said they'd look after me and get me to a nicer prison. And Rockwell City is a very modern prison. It's a much safer place. But then he adds, but you know, Fort Madison, they got cable TV, and Rockwell City doesn't. So I found that kind of interesting.
It's all about quality of life, yes.
It's all about quality of life. But so these are the two witnesses that testified against the guy. And, you know, it's concerning. I mean, a lot of things that I've heard, you know, on your episodes and other cases that have been questionable, you know, there's a trend here. You know, you have a cellmate testifying. You have some documents that apparently weren't turned over, or at least an appellate court has found that they weren't turned over. You have some things that are kind of a trend here, wouldn't you guys say?
Well, it doesn't look good. But now you also mentioned that there is real evidence against him.
Well, the evidence is pretty scant.
Pretty thin. Oh, okay.
It's the parents of this little girl who died. Her name is Jennifer Lewis. And one of the things that's different about this podcast is we really focus in on the victim as well. We think it's really important that she not get lost in the mix. She grew up in really tragic circumstances, desperately poor family, just because there's some racial issues here. The family was white. Stanley Liggins is African-American. The mother of this girl testified that she got to know Stanley Liggins while her husband was in jail. And she needed to get bail money. So she says she began selling cocaine for Stanley Liggins. He was supplying it, and she was selling it in the west end of Rock Island, Illinois. So he had a connection to the family. He had a criminal history. He had some problems in his past. And quite naturally, the police began to really look at him. And one of the things, they brought him in for questioning, and they put him through a polygraph, and they say that he didn't pass the polygraph. And at that point, he became the focus of the investigation. And they really bored in hard. And I talked to the prosecutor who worked the case at the time. He said, hey, I ask everybody in my office, you know, you think we should charge him now or we shouldn't? And he said, almost to a person, they all said, don't charge him. You don't have enough evidence. And he said, but, you know, I'm accountable to the voters of Scott County, Iowa. And I feel like it's my decision that counts here. And this is all on the record. And they decided to charge him. And then 3 days later, this witness comes forward that said she saw the taillights, and then they kind of built from there. But there's the amount of evidence, and he had a lot of proximity to the family, and that's for certain. He has a long criminal record, and he's got a violent history. He's not a good man, I should say, at that point, he certainly wasn't a good man. Now, I haven't talked to him for 26 years, but it's a fascinating case, and it's really divided the community up quite a bit, and there's just a lot of twists and turns in here, and there's an alternate suspect out there that people have pointed to, the defense has pointed to. It just, I think your listeners will find this to be a really interesting one to listen to, too. Again, it's at suspectconvictions.com, or you can find Suspect Convictions on iTunes.
Okay, so now I'd like to take a moment to introduce to you Seema Iyer. She's a former prosecutor and a criminal justice attorney. She's a TV legal analyst and the host of the Bollywood Lawyer podcast. Also, you can find all of Seema's coverage of Adnan Syed's case at thebollywoodlawyer.com. Welcome to the show again, Seema.
Oh my God, this is the biggest thrill of my life, John Cryer. Thank you for having me.
This is it, folks. You heard it. It's being recorded for posterity. Thank you for being here, Seema. I appreciate it so much. I wanted to say also, the podcast lately, The Bollywood Lawyer, has been delving into the Tyra Patterson case, which is fascinating to me. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And first, I have to start off by giving the undisclosed team credit for the reason I am involved with the Tyra Patterson case. It is one of the Adnan Syed supporters that connected me with Tyra Patterson's lawyer. And they said, maybe you can help. Maybe you can do something. So that's why we've done this Tyra Patterson series. In essence, on September 20th, 1994, Tyra was with a group of people, and that group of people, who she did not know very well at all, decided to rob another group of victims, which were five young ladies. And both groups of people, everybody was pretty young, I must say. So Tyra was in this location. It was the parking lot area of her apartment complex, and Tyra was with her best friend Becca, and that was really her only friend. And they did nothing but they were in the vicinity of the robbery. The robbery, which of course requires violence along with the theft, escalated to a point where one of the young women who was involved in the robbery pulled out a gun and shot one of the girls in the car. And that victim, her name was Michelle Lay. She was 15 years old and she was killed. And Tyra had actually, with her best friend Becca, had been walking away from the scene much before the actual shooting occurred. Tyra's fatal mistake was that she picked up something off the ground, which was a necklace. That necklace had been thrown to the ground away from the scene by another one of the robbery participants. So Tyra, though, she immediately went to her home and called 911. And I know everybody here is a fan of these legal issues, and that was the first major mistake in the case. The defense attorney never played the 911 call that Tyra made to bring help to the victims. That was never played to the jury. So Tyra gets picked up with her friend Becca. She says she has nothing to do with it. She claims that she's innocent, and time passes, and now she asserts that it was, in essence, a false conviction, that the detective, the lead detective, had threatened her to confess, and she falsely confessed. And she did tell her trial lawyers that at the time, that wasn't brought out. So she's been in jail for 22 years, or prison rather. She's always claimed that she is innocent. And as we sit here today, Michelle Lay's sister, who was in the car, who was another victim, has come forward finally and corroborated Tyra's innocence. Additionally, all of the other co-defendants, and there are five in total, all of them, including Tyra, everybody's passed polygraphs. Everybody says that Tyra didn't do anything. She wasn't involved with the robbery, and she certainly wasn't involved with the murder.
Well, it brought up some interesting issues because originally she was convicted because she was grouped with the attackers. And it brings up an interesting issue, just, you know, what is inherent about somebody that makes them part of a group? She didn't know those people. She was barely acquainted with them. She had been in a car with a couple of them earlier. And as Colin and I have discussed on the show, there are a lot of laws where people are held culpable for crimes committed by a group, even if they didn't actually participate in the crime.
That's true. But in this case, there was testimony at trial, which is now being held in question, of the extent of Tyra's participation. Because at trial, there were victims who testified that Tyra said things that initiated the robbery, participated in the robbery. And there was also even an accusation that she may have told the shooter to shoot the victim. So those facts, I can see, are reasonable that a jury would come up with a guilty verdict. But now that the case has been further investigated and has been uncovered, that didn't happen. But here's the deal. The truth is, there were witnesses who could have corroborated Tyra's story, that she wasn't at the location. She didn't say the words that corroborated the robbery, that she didn't participate in the violence, that she wasn't at the scene. But that person was never called by the defense to testify. And what makes this worse, and that was Becca, her best friend. Becca was in front of the courtroom during the trial. And to this day, we have no idea why she wasn't called as a witness.
She attended the entirety of the trial?
Not the entirety, but she was there for at least a day.
So she was present, just not called. Now, what is the status? Has she appealed? Are there appeals pending?
There are no appeals pending. She's exhausted all her appeal options. The status now is that either they are trying to get her pardoned by the governor, or they're going to try to go back to court with the victim's recantation. The Michelle Lay sister, Holly Lay, who's come forward, who's also, she was on one episode of the podcast, but The Guardian, for the listeners, The Guardian has done an entire series on Tyra Patterson that goes really in depth as well.
And I also want to compliment you on the access that you've gotten to people, that you actually got an interview with the prosecutor, I thought was just remarkable. And it provided some real depth in the case. I'm really glad he came forward.
Yes. He was very, I almost stroked out when I did that interview because we were yelling and screaming bloody murder at each other. But he was very generous with his time, and he really, I don't understand why he's just sticking to his guns so firmly. I simply don't understand, because he really is quite a reasonable man, but he just doesn't see that. He doesn't see the facts before him, and he doesn't see the change in testimony and circumstances that have occurred over the last 22 years.
Do you think prosecutors have come to grips with the amount of false confessions that happen?
I don't think that they believe that all false confessions are truly false confessions.
You think that they think that there's some sort of grain of truth that they're trying to hide or obfuscate their actual, that they actually did have something to do with it?
Yes. And I, on one hand, listen, it is reasonable that prosecutors think that, because if you are like me, I was a prosecutor, I'm a defense attorney. If you're in this every single day of your life, all everybody does is lie. I don't believe that there are that many wrongfully incarcerated people, by the way. I think that a lot of people who are in prison, maybe most people, belong there. Maybe not for as long as they are there, but they belong there. I think Tyra is rare. I think Joey Watkins is rare. And I think Scott's case is probably another rarity. But you have to understand, when everybody and their mother now comes and says, oh, it was a false confession, the cops beat me up, it's like, really? Are you just doing this now because everyone's talking about it, because it's the new it girl in town?
Well, I think it is valuable for people to understand that they do happen. I think there was an ironclad, even I have to say myself, back in the 70s or in the early 80s when the Central Park Five case was happening in New York City, I absolutely believed their first confessions. And in retrospect, they were completely wrong. I had that bedrock thinking that if you've confessed, you know, you're up to something. And that's why I brought up the prosecutor thing is, you know, these are prosecutors who do deal with people who lie every day. They deal with criminals who, you know, generally, if you've made a career of being a criminal, you're not about honesty, you know. So I have to figure that it affects their worldview. But also seeing what happens in interrogations and seeing how the Reed technique has sort of, you know, twisted how interrogations happen. You know, it feels like perhaps that hasn't really culturally infected the community of prosecutors. And I ask you that because you're a former prosecutor yourself.
I agree. And I will say this, even with Tyra, I was not completely on board until her lawyer had affidavits from suspects that the detective had interrogated and similarly threatened. So when I had all of that corroboration in front of me, I said, okay, I do believe her beyond a reasonable doubt, where I didn't before necessarily. It's very hard, I think, as a former prosecutor, to see a police officer that they would do that they would put their life, their career, their pension on the line by threatening witnesses and suspects. And especially Tyra. I mean, Tyra was a child. She was 19 years old. So it's very hard to completely believe that. And by the way, you know, I practice in Manhattan. I have a case with the Central Park 5 DA, and people here still think that they did it or they did something.
Well, our president still believes that they did something. That was his last statement on it. And not our current president, but the president-elect at this point.
Right.
Yeah. And to my knowledge, there is no evidence that they were participating in any particular act of criminality that night. And even if so, still it doesn't justify arresting them for a rape that they did not participate in. Now, have you been listening to Undisclosed of late? Have you heard the last couple of episodes?
I have.
So I'd love to hear from you and from Scott, because I'm sure the type of things that Joey Watkins was dealing with both in his trial and in his appeals process are, you know, maddeningly typical in the justice system. And this reaction was shared with a lot of people who listen to the podcast, of just futile rage at the process, at how the little things compounded to make it impossible for Joey to get any real recourse legally in this case.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think, okay, so my two glaring deficiencies were the whole grave dog thing. That's just one topic. And the other issue, and this is I'm actually stealing Susan's words, was that it was scientifically impossible, according to the cell phone evidence, that Joey Watkins could have committed this act. And just taking it further, in the last episode, the lawyer said it was part of his strategy. So I'm still waiting for the answer of what the strategy was. And also couching all of this with the fact that I absolutely hate More Than Life itself having to throw another lawyer under the bus. But I'm still waiting for the answer on what the hell the strategy was.
Well, I actually had a question, and this is also for Colin. Rex Abernathy, his attorney, in some respects really torpedoed Joey Watkins' appeal because he claimed that not introducing the cell evidence, or at least highlighting it in the manner that made it clear that it was impossible for Joey to participate in the crime, or at least for the state's case to be correct. I'm trying to understand why an attorney would do that. I mean, I understand there's pride, and perhaps it was part of a strategy, but as you mentioned, it's not a strategy that makes sense or worked, clearly. But are there repercussions for him? Like, let's say he did say, you know what, I blew it. It was a strategy that I was nervous about, and it didn't quite work. If he had said that, you know, under questioning, would that have necessarily hurt him as an attorney in some way?
He wouldn't be sanctioned. The question would be whether other potential clients would be deterred, but I don't think so, because if you see a lawyer openly and honestly admitting to mistakes, that's something I think a lot of people would like in a prospective attorney. It's my opinion, it is also sort of wounded pride. He doesn't want to admit that he made a mistake because, as Seema was saying, if you look at this record in the case, you look at the testing that was done with the cell towers, this was an ironclad defense, and there's not a logical reason why this was not pursued and vigorously advanced at trial.
And the way Susan made it, I think she said in the last episode, it's just one sentence. That's all they had to say to the jury. It is scientifically impossible for this person to have committed that crime. Let's go home, call it a day, have a good night.
Right. And Rex Abernathy's point is to say, it was too close, and we didn't want to focus on it too much because if we did so, the prosecution could oppose it. But you're exactly right, Seema. This would have been very easy to say, here's the map, here's the last point at which he could have pinged this tower, and scientifically, there's no way he could have driven from point A to the murder scene in time to be able to commit this crime, and he didn't do it.
Do you think the defense attorney didn't understand that? I mean, is that why he didn't field that defense, or... I've been just trying to wrap my head around when I was listening to it. Why that wasn't brought forward? Is it just that he just lacked the understanding of it? What do you think happened here?
That is what Bill O'Dell seems to say, that this was a lack of understanding. And I'm sympathetic to that position because I just, when I look at this evidence, when all of us have looked at this evidence and broken down what the state's narrative and timeline is, you look at the cell tower pings, you look at the locations. If you understand this, you're absolutely presenting that to the jury. This is the strongest possible argument you could have. So I think that you're right, that it just has to be a case where he didn't fully comprehend this cell tower ping evidence, and that's the real reason he didn't present it.
But wait, Colin, didn't they have their own expert?
They did.
So how did he not understand it? Didn't the expert explain it to him? Like, hey, yo, couldn't have done it. Lock it out.
I mean, the expert testifies at the habeas proceeding that after Tammy Colston, the prosecutor, showed him the evidence, that he, in the room with her and defense counsel, said, you have real problems because the timing here with the cell tower pings doesn't make sense. So it's tough to me imagining how he couldn't have figured out what this was. But I mean, that was his testimony at habeas, was in front of the prosecutor and defense attorneys, I explained why your case doesn't work.
Okay.
I think a lot of us felt that way. Yes, it's very frustrating. Now, I noticed also that the appeals court misstated some of Steffes's evidence. Well, they didn't misstate it. They claimed that he said, yes, it was physically possible for the ping to have occurred, but they were taking away the wrong thing. He said it was physically possible if helicopters held a piece of tinfoil at exactly the right angle. And, you know, so when somebody says something like that, when somebody says something that's saying, obviously, it is physically possible, but incredibly unlikely, and a court says, oh, well, he said it's physically possible, and writes off a very real point of contention saying something like that. Is there any redress for that? Because that was later, I think, affirmed at the federal level. Am I correct?
It was. And it's one of those things where, unfortunately, the Georgia courts, there was this recent case, the Foster case, which involved an alleged Batson violation. This was the case where we had Bill Rankin on before, where he was describing it. Literally, the prosecutor put the letter B next to the names of the African-American jurors. And the Georgia court found this was not a Batson violation, meaning this was not a racially discriminatory use of jury challenges. And it's tough. It's tough on appeal in Georgia. I mean, the Supreme Court did reverse that one, but in a habeas, it's really tough to get the federal habeas court to review factual findings by the state court. And my guess is that the federal court in this case just sort of looked at the state record and said, this is how they characterized the expert's testimony. We're not going to really dig into it too deeply, and we're just going to sort of give a rubber stamp on appeal. If there's a legal issue, we might review that, but factually, we're not going to review the record that specifically.
What happened at the appellate court? I mean, I better give you a little background on myself. I've been covered the Illinois State House for more than 17 years. I covered the Illinois Supreme Court. Did a lot of those things. Did they just not read the trial transcripts closely, or were they willfully ignorant, or what was going on here? I mean, is there some underlying, I don't want to use the word political motivation, but motivation that we aren't seeing? What's going on here? Because that seems to me almost being totally blind to what was said in the original trial.
Yeah, I think it's tough when you have a case where a person is convicted of murder and there was a lot of bad character evidence that came in. It's tough for the appellate court to reverse that unless there's really something glaring. I mean, I don't know obviously what the thought process was of each of the individual justices, but I can imagine them sitting down, or their clerk sitting down and looking at this and saying, maybe there's some plausible grounds for an appeal here, but there's all this character evidence. It's a murder trial. We're not going to reverse in this case.
But also, the state of Georgia has changed the laws about the character evidence. All that stuff nowadays would not be admitted. Am I correct?
No, unfortunately not. No, Georgia, they didn't used to have codified rules of evidence based off the federal rules. A few years ago, they did codify those rules, but all this character evidence that came in against Joey, that same evidence at a trial of someone with the same type of evidentiary record would likely get in. They still allow the prosecutor to proffer, here's the character evidence. They still allow evidence or prior difficulties to come in. They still have a really expansive definition of similar transactions that allows almost all types of somewhat similar evidence to come in. So Georgia is notorious for allowing character evidence in, and it really hasn't changed since this trial back in 2001.
Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans proudly supports Undisclosed. If you've ever been in the market for a new house, you know how difficult the mortgage lending process can be. Between finding the right lender, one that's trustworthy and who will help you secure a great rate, to filling out what seems like never-ending amounts of paperwork, getting a mortgage can be a really stressful deal. If you're in the market for a mortgage and you want to try to alleviate some of that stress, check out Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. With Rocket Mortgage, you'll get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. Don't waste time searching through stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial info to get a mortgage approval in minutes. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the mortgage solution that's right for you. Whether you're looking to buy a home or refinance your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/undisclosed. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I had another small point about what the appeals court mentioned, which is that the Yvonne Agin evidence was characterized as cumulative, but also it was characterized as some of the most important character evidence. Well, can that difference of the way that they characterize it be exploited on appeal?
Yeah, well, Sima, I'm interested from your perspective. I mean, this was the Yvonne Agin testimony that came in under George's necessity exception. Have you ever used as a prosecutor or seen as defense counsel the admission of statements under the federal or the state catch-all or residual hearsay exception?
Of necessity?
No, the hearsay exception that exists at the
the catch-all.
Right, the sort of the catch-all. It's very rare that evidence comes in under that. I don't know if you've ever even involved in a case where this came in.
I haven't. I've tried about 150 plus, and I watch. I'm a huge, as you know, Colin, I like to watch court proceedings. So no, I've never heard of it. And I have the decision in front of me. I read it. I reread it. I listened to the episode. I really wasn't even clear on why it was being admitted.
Yeah. And John, to your point, we have the rule against hearsay. And as I explained in the episode, you have these specified hearsay exceptions. And then there's this Hail Mary. It's this catch-all or necessity or residual exception. And that's supposed to be reserved for the most reliable evidence that is more significant and more relevant and probative than any other evidence. And so to your point, yeah, when the court says an appeal, this is cumulative. And they note that Agan had charges against her and didn't come forward until the weekend before trial. There's no way this should have come in under the necessity exception. This should have been excluded without even a consideration to admit.
And still, it still has to be weighed against the prejudice. So even before we get into this catch-all exception, they should have weighed it against the potential prejudice. And for that reason, I don't see why it was allowed in.
Yeah, I wish that the appeals were a little bit more specific because, John, you're exactly right. Once they saw that there was language at the lower court saying this was cumulative, they should have really focused on that and said there's no way this should have come in under the necessity exception. And it was argued in an okay manner. I wish it could have been pressed more vigorously, but I don't know that it made a difference with the court in Georgia.
And it would appear that Tammy Colston might have committed a Brady violation in the course of this by repeatedly claiming that no bullet was recovered from the grave dog. Would that be possibly appealable either as a Brady violation or would that be her conceivably committing perjury?
That would be definitely a potential Brady violation. And Brady doesn't require bad faith, but it doesn't hurt. And so certainly if we believe that she was intentionally lying under oath about the recovery of this bullet, that would be something that would be very helpful in arguing a Brady violation.
But isn't it, and Colin, let me ask you, isn't it true that she's almost immune from a perjury accusation because of her prosecutorial immunity? Because as long as she's acting within the duties of her job, she's not going to be accused of perjury.
Oh, right. In terms of a civil action against her or even a criminal action, she would have prosecutorial immunity. But just in terms of if Joey is attacking his conviction on appeal, then you claim
Brady.
It right to support that right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wouldn't be considered perjury. I guess that's the wrong word.
Right, no, she's not testifying under oath, but it would be.
Right. But no, actually, John, I'm glad you brought that up because I think it's a really interesting issue about what prosecutors can get away with and not get away with. And people don't talk about it enough. So it was just interesting that you did.
And by the way, one thing that struck me as very odd about that moment in the trial transcript is that the judge repeatedly questions her about it as though even he finds it a little odd that the bullet was not extracted. Am I the only one who came away feeling that way?
I agree.
And I think
I agree.
We mentioned the notice of similar transactions that it does mention the bullet that was recovered. So maybe the judge himself was looking at this and saying, well, wait a second, was a bullet recovered or not? Because there were certain proffers in this case that seemed to indicate that a bullet was recovered.
Yeah. And actually, we've got a terrific social media question about that from Mary Greason Heredia, who asks, how can they get around providing 10-day notice when it is clear that someone was aware of the information prior to trial? In order to recover the animal and request testing and receive returned evidence, it takes a lot more than 10 days.
Yeah, it's a great point. This looks to me like a clear Brady violation. I don't see any two ways about it or any way around the discovery laws. This had to be turned over.
But didn't Tammy say something like she didn't have the notice to give?
Well, that's what we're saying. I mean, obviously, it was submitted for scientific testing with some lead time. I mean, by the way, it's not clear to me how much lead time they actually had. I mean, perhaps that's actually in the podcast, but I don't know if you remember, Colin.
I'm not sure exactly.
Yeah. But again, you know, these labs are not known for being super fast.
Right. Especially back then.
Yes, exactly. So we got another social media question, and we actually got a lot of these, which was, was the cell tower evidence properly explained to that vehement juror that was interviewed in the episode a couple of weeks ago? What did she say when that penny dropped? And another person asked, that juror blew my mind. She was so sure she was right. Is there any legal remedy when jurors misunderstand facts? And I was curious, Colin, I don't know if you know if Susan has actually talked to Rosemary, the juror in question.
Yeah, so a couple points on that. My understanding is that Susan has not, and our approach has been not to disclose to the jurors what we've discovered, just to get their impressions, and therefore we have the record of that in case it's needed for appeal. Now, In terms of whether a juror incorrectly understanding the facts can lead to an appeal, the answer is no. We have a rule of evidence, Rule 606B, and it says if jurors misunderstood facts, jury instructions, etc., they can't, quote unquote, impeach their verdict based upon incorrect understanding. That's to prevent jury harassment, to have finality of verdicts, etc. There are exceptions for outside influences or jurors doing research on their own, so there are some important exceptions. Seema, interestingly enough, I know you had a whole episode on The Bollywood Lawyer about the Tyra Patterson case, and you talked to the jurors, and sort of what was the approach you took with them?
Well, it was different for me because the attorney, Tyra's attorney, David Singleton, of the Ohio Justice Policy Center, he had already told every juror what was revealed, which was A, the 911 call. So that was the first question for the jurors. If you knew about the 911 call during the trial, would that have changed your verdict? And this is already something that he explored with these jurors. And then the other issue about the false confession.
Right.
So I was very lucky because I can see that. That's a scary place to be. You don't know if you're supposed to reveal new evidence or the investigation. It could hurt Joey's case. So it's a little different. But I didn't have to do that.
Yeah, and I listened to that. I had a very similar reaction to what you had about the lawyers not more powerfully presenting the cell tower evidence. Because when you actually hear this 911 call by Tyra Patterson about the incident that wasn't played for the jury, I mean, it completely changed the way I viewed the case. I don't know if you had the same reaction.
Oh, of course. Right. Because it was so contemporaneous, right? She went straight to her house, and I've been to the area. So it's a very tiny little apartment complex. And just a few yards away, she goes and she calls. And she flushed the necklace down the toilet, by the way, for whatever that means. She did do that. But she called right away, and the jurors thought that would have been very compelling. Oh, another issue, I'm sorry, I just want to throw this out there, is that she wanted to testify.
Right.
And her lawyers told her she shouldn't.
And my understanding, I can't remember if it was on the podcast or if I read it, that they found her too hood. Was that right?
Yeah.
But she had no criminal record and
none.
From hearing her talk, I mean, she comes off very well to me. And I think you noted in the podcast that you thought the jurors would have found her sympathetic.
Well, also, she comes from a very difficult background. By the way, that interview with her mother was one of the most heartrending episodes of a podcast I've ever heard.
Thank you for listening.
And her mother was very honest. She did not pull any punches either way when she was discussing Tyra in the case, I thought.
No, the mother is very honest right now. And off the record, she started off quite defensive because she was nervous that I was being accusatory, which I'm very judgmental, so I can see that she would be like that. But she was completely honest and forthcoming. And my opinion is that by watching the confession video, quote unquote, I think Tyra would have come across very endearing to the jury, despite the way she spoke. Maybe she didn't speak perfect English, but who does? She was a young girl. She would have come across well.
I have another social media question. This is from Amy Hassler, who says, okay, crazy theory. As a mom of teenagers, Yvonne Agin's testimony set off red flags. I guess if this story came out the day after Isaac was shot, maybe it would be more believable. But the sudden urgency to get it on the record before the trial is suspect. But it struck me that Yvonne's story wasn't really about explaining how scared Isaac was of Joey. It was more about explaining why Isaac just happened to spend the night at her house while her son and husband were out. Does Yvonne's husband or son have a history of violence? It's no crazier than saying Joey did it over Brianne.
I'm not aware of any such history of violence, but many people have noted that her testimony, the timing and the substance are very odd. And I think people can sort of judge that for themselves based upon what she describes in the case.
Another question we've got is from Savannah Elizabeth Albanez, who says, is it possible that in the statement, the dog is taken care of, that that could actually be dog, D-A-W-G, as in my dog is in the clear? Also, is it at all possible that the dog on the grave was actually Isaac's dog being returned? I know it's a grisly idea, But they, you know, they're just spitballing here. Savannah's taking a shot. But no, I think the amount of time in between, I don't know if the breeds were the same. I don't know. It seems like the amount of time would have precluded that particular possibility, because wasn't the dog shot in August and the dog was found at the graveyard, I think, in February, I believe. I'm not 100% certain of that. But it seems like an awful long time.
Yeah, and I think all these questions you're asking, it gets to the fundamental point again, where there was not conditional relevance here. And this is, I mentioned this last time that Seema was on, that we would talk about this later, is in this case, Tammy Colston essentially said, we're going to present evidence throughout trial which will substantiate our claim that this dog was placed on the grave after being shot by Joey or Mark Free. And that evidence just never materialized. And we have all these question marks, and I don't know. I don't know any of the answers to these questions, and the jurors and the judge didn't either, which is why this prejudicial evidence, as we see from the jurors' statements, never should have reached the jury.
Well, obviously, Rosemary, by the way, who sounded like she actually was taking the responsibility very seriously. She's not a dumb lady. And she came at, you know, like the jailhouse testimony with a skeptical attitude. But all that, as you said, all that information just seeped in somehow. And it's the job of a defense attorney to blow that stuff out of the water. Like the whole grave dog thing, even if you let that in, my mind has always boggled that they didn't emphasize that the dog was not actually found on top of the grave. Does that seem like a huge oversight to you guys?
Okay, so I just think, let's take away all the law. It's really simple. The rule is, if it doesn't directly connect the defendant to the crime, it shouldn't be allowed in. I'm just dumbing it down for myself. Okay.
And for me, thank you.
And that's the problem with the grave dog. That is why it should not have, just because it could have been connected, that's not good enough.
So is there a restriction on rules of what the lawyers can say in opening arguments? I mean, could that be grounds for mistrial and they say, hey, we're going to show you this, and then they never show it to you?
Yes. Yeah, so this is conditional relevance. It's rule of evidence 104B. And what it says is that oftentimes we'll have evidence and we'll have relevance, but there's an intermediate step, which is conditional relevance. So in this case, it would be we have this quote unquote grave dog, and our relevance would be this shows that if Joey or Mark killed the dog and placed it there, obviously there was animosity toward Isaac in this case. And this is what was done in this case, known as a subject to admission, meaning we had a promise in the opening statement by Tammy Colston, and she had to fill in that blank, the conditional relevance throughout trial. And when she didn't do the evidence later in the trial, defense absolutely could have moved for a mistrial and said, look, there was a promise here. That promise was unfulfilled. This evidence is extremely prejudicial. You need to declare a mistrial so we can start over, and the jury never hears about this evidence.
But the defense never actually took that tack?
They did not.
So has anybody asked the defense attorney, you know, we've asked about what legal strategy was, you know, questions like that, why wasn't this done, that sort of thing? I mean,
yeah, a lot of what we've mostly talked to Bill O'Dell and not so much to Rex Abernathy. He's sort of tough to get a hold of. But their common theme is, going back to our Bobby Lee Cook episode, that this was a case, it was supposed to be Bobby Lee Cook at first, then Branch Connolly. And then a few weeks before trial, Branch Connolly asked off the case, maybe took a trip to Europe and dropped it in the lap of Abernathy, who got help from O'Dell. And they sort of felt they were behind the eight ball the whole time. They said they asked for a continuance. It was denied. And they felt like they were playing a game of catch up the whole time.
But also, I wonder if when defense attorneys are in that situation, they worry that they risk reminding the jurors of evidence that looks bad if they fight it too much. Do you feel like that comes up in trials?
I think that's a great point. I think sometimes you don't want to highlight something, but this is a major issue that affects your client's appeal. So sometimes you have to. And you can do certain things like a mistrial motion outside the presence of the jury as well.
Right. Yeah, the timing here would be once the prosecution rests its case, defense can then ask for the jury to be excused, or when it's the end of the day and it's the next day, and ask the judge, Your Honor, we had these promises during opening statement or these claims of conditional relevance. And outside the presence of the jury, say, Your Honor, there was never evidence to tie this grave dog to my client. And therefore, I'm asking for either A, you to explain to the jury they're not to consider it, which then that you know, is the whole ironic process theory. We worry about it drawing the attention to the jury, but they could certainly ask for a mistrial on those grounds, and that wasn't done here.
Is that still an option for them?
It is not an option for them to say that defense counsel should have asked for a mistrial on Grave Dog. The Brady violation regarding Grave Dog, that's potentially a viable issue. Brady violations, if they weren't known until after the latest appeal, assuming they're brought in a timely fashion, that's a potential ground for appeal.
And I have to say, just as a listener, I'm very much looking forward to the next episode of Undisclosed, which will go through what are the possibilities for Joey, as well as how we can help.
Right, exactly. Hopefully, we've uncovered some things throughout the course of this investigation and podcast that will allow for a fairly prompt appeal.
Yeah. Has anybody at this point talked about seeking a pardon or a commutation from the governor of Georgia?
They in Georgia, my understanding is it's not the governor. It's actually a board that they have and that he would seek that. So my thinking, I don't know, Claire will be on the addendum next week, but my thinking is, from this current investigation, there can be an appeal and we'll see about that. And if that fails, maybe at that point you go for the pardon.
We had one more social media question. This is from It's All Just Beachy, who asks, is there any way we can know if Joey Boyd had a red car that Isaac has mentioned and written down the license plate number?
We probably could go through old records. Yeah, and that's something where I think the Georgia Innocence Project looks at Heath Wilson as the more viable suspect and hasn't really considered Joey Boyd. So I'm not sure how much they've investigated or not, and I'm not sure how viable he actually is, but I imagine that we could find the car records to see what car he was driving back in 2001, and that might bear fruit.
We also got this from Janessa Thomas, who asks about Heath's ex-girlfriend. She was adamant that it wasn't him and they were nowhere near, but she asked if she needed an attorney and whatnot. If she essentially said anything but the fact that he didn't do it that night, couldn't she make herself an accessory to the murder? And I guess she's suggesting that perhaps she's being untruthful at this point because she'd be considered an accessory.
Okay, so there's two types of accessory. One is accessory before the fact. That person would have had to have assisted in the crime or advised the person to commit the crime and had the intent the crime be committed. So likely she's off on that. Then there's what Jay Wilds was convicted of in the Adnan Syed case, which is accessory after the fact. And given what we said about them going to Heath Wilson's house and sort of the cover up of him having the 9mm gun, that is somewhat of an issue there. If she came forward now and said he actually did this shooting and I helped to conceal the fact that he was involved, there's a potential liability for accessory after the fact there.
Got it. But she wouldn't have been considered an accessory had she come forward then.
Correct.
So Scott and Seema, having listened to the podcast, do you guys have any questions for Colin?
One of the things that I wondered about was, you know, having covered a lot of trials and covered a lot of appeals, what was the background of the trial judge? Was he a former prosecutor? Was he somebody who came from a political background? I mean, a former state legislator? What was his background? How did he come to be a judge? I mean, we all bring our own worldviews into whatever we do. So that's why I'm just kind of wondering, because he didn't seem particularly, I don't know, open-minded perhaps towards the defense, or maybe that wasn't the proper word to use, but you know what I'm saying?
He just seemed very lenient about the evidence, about the character evidence and the prior bad acts evidence.
He was in the Navy and served in Vietnam. He then went to law school at Mercer, I think Mercer for law school and undergrad. And then he worked at a private law firm in Rome, Georgia for however many years before he became a judge. So I think he was a private attorney. I'm not sure exactly what his practice involved, what types of cases.
But more than likely, probably primarily civil cases as opposed to criminal cases.
Probably. I'm guessing, but yeah, I'm not 100% sure.
But that would be an interesting segue to go from civil cases to criminal court.
Yes. And that's not uncommon, unfortunately, that you have that happen. I just was curious what his background was, because there were some things that happened in that courtroom that I just found very curious.
I agree. When you mentioned, Scott, earlier that was there a political connection, motivation, actually, when we say that word political in that respect, I felt the same way, because we don't know the backgrounds of all these people and how they're connected and how they know each other.
Yeah, so looking at this, he was appointed in 1988 by the governor. He was filling an unexpired term of a retiring judge. But again, I'm not sure of what his practice experience exactly was before he joined the bench.
But I think if he'd been, say, you know, a prosecutor, you might have said, oh, OK, well, I can see why he's allowing all that extra evidence in. He understands that there's a lot of police work going involved. And who knows? I mean, you know, but
also, you don't know who their friends are. You don't know who they have drinks with, who they socialize with. You don't know anything that's going on in the background.
I always wondered about that because I understand lawyers and judges are going to know each other. They're going to socialize. They're going to, you know, they're in the same business. Have you guys become masters of small talk? Because you can't talk about anything that actually is happening during the day. What do you people talk about?
You mean with lawyers and judges?
Yeah. The weather?
People talk about sports. People talk about their kids, which is very boring and annoying. And people talk about other lawyers and other judges.
Oh, that's
a big one.
And I'm sure, Colin, you know this. I don't know if, John, you know this. Scott, you probably know this. But every courthouse in the world has the courthouse bar. So there's always a bar behind the courthouse where everybody hangs out. And inevitably, you will just all be hanging out together. And you'll all be drinking a little too much. And then you'll all start talking too much. And then somebody makes out with somebody.
And obviously, you know, we're talking about wrongful convictions, so we're talking about where the process goes awry. And obviously, on a daily basis, this system doesn't necessarily cause corruption on a huge scale. These are human beings, and we're all professionals, and everybody's trying to do their best. But at some point, you do have to look and say, okay, why is this happening? Although it sounds to me like the laws in Georgia are already so predisposed. It didn't sound like he was doing anything completely inappropriate in terms of how he proceeded with the case.
No, I wasn't saying he was doing something inappropriate. It just seemed like when the close calls were coming in, the close calls all seemed to be going towards the prosecution rather than to the defense. That's just what my impression was from listening in. I may not be correct there, but that was just the impression I was left with.
Yeah, I agree. And the question I have is whether this is just how it works in Georgia, because I just saw that Justin Ross Harris, this is the Breakdown podcast, the child in a hot car case. Following that, it was exactly the same. A lot of evidentiary rulings, I would think, in many other jurisdictions would have gone in favor of the defense, went to the prosecution, and he's appealing some of those evidentiary rulings. So I'll be interested to see. That is a judge in that case who was a former prosecutor, whether on appeal those are successful, because if not, that just tends to tell me in Georgia this is pretty much how it works.
Well, I just wanted to say thank you so much, Seema, and thank you so much, Scott. Scott, again, it is Suspect Convictions. That's the podcast that's just coming out now.
Suspect Convictions. Yeah, it's available on iTunes as well as suspectconvictions.com.
And Seema, obviously the Bollywood lawyer, I've enjoyed it greatly. Your work on the Tyra Patterson case is fantastic. And thank you so much for being on the show once again.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, Colin. Have a great week. And I will talk to you next week. Looking forward.
Take care. Look forward to some big news next week.
And that's all we've got for this week's addendum. Now, earlier in the podcast, we talked about the case of Tyra Patterson. And if you want to help the people helping Tyra, they are the Ohio Justice and Policy Center. The OJPC's mission is to create fair, intelligent, redemptive criminal justice systems through zealous, client-centered advocacy, innovative policy reform, and community education. In 1997, Cincinnati civil rights attorney Alphonse Gerhardstein saw a problem. The prison population was in the middle of unprecedented and historic growth. People with few resources to obtain legal representation, disproportionately black, were being locked up en masse. When they went through those prison gates, they faced overcrowded facilities, violence, and denial of basic human rights like medical care, and it was nearly impossible for them to get representation in court to protect or restore their basic human dignity. Al wanted solutions for Ohio and a force to protect the people caught in the system. Since their founding, OJPC has fought in federal court to protect the basic human rights and dignity of incarcerated people in Ohio. Attorneys must serve the client first and foremost, and they must listen with compassion, they must fight zealously for their client, and as experience has taught him, they must never write anyone off. The OJPC saw many of the people it represented in prison try to re-enter society after completing their sentences. Their clients hit barrier after barrier and were in effect being shut out of meaningful... Their clients hit barrier after barrier and were, in effect, being shut out of a meaningful second chance. In 2004, the OJPC established its Second Chance Services for people with criminal records who were rebuilding lives for themselves and for their families. And if you want to help the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, you can reach them on the web at ohiojpc.org. Fans can discuss the show on Twitter at #undisclosed or #justiceforjoey. If you want to tag questions for future addenda, you can use the #UDAddendum, or you can tweet them directly at me at Mr. John Cryer. And as always, the case documents and photos are posted at the undisclosed-podcast.com website. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle @UndisclosedPod, and also our key partner, the Georgia Innocence Project, at GA Innocence. I'm going to thank Hannah McCarthy once again, and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media for our audio production, Patrick Cortez for our excellent music and addenda theme, and Meethal Telhand, who is our project manager. Thanks once again for a great show. As we wind down, I'm going to thank the listeners once again for sticking around. Talk soon.